go. Okay. We're recording. We're talking to Ty Robinson, and Ty was a lobbyist in the 1950s and 60s,
into the 70s.
But has a political legacy in Montana, especially in Flathead County, that goes back maybe even into the 30s, maybe even into the 20s.
Hardly that.
Well, you mentioned Governor Erickson.
Yes.
And Erickson, of course, was governor from the 1920s into the 1930s.
That is correct.
What are your recollections of him?
Only that I remember he came to our house a couple times, and I was quite young. But my father was a friend of his, and I remember my father killing some deer, taking meat over to the Ericksons. I remember that phase of it, and I just knew that he was the judge, and in those days that was all powerful, and you were very fearful of the judge. But he was a rather tall man in a sense in those days. Had a nice way of presenting himself, as I recall. And I guess that's about all I can tell you, Bob, about the man, because I know that when I was in high school there, Judge Erickson made the commencement address at one time to the graduating class. I remember that, and usually probably a good public speaker, but I'm not aware fully of that.
He was a district judge, I think, in the 19-teens and 1920s, perhaps, and then he was elected governor in 1924. He defeated Joe Dixon in a contested campaign, I know.
He defeated Joe Dixon, of course, because Missoula Mercantile Company and the Anaconda Company unloaded Joe. The Missoula Mercantile Company was primarily responsible for helping Joe to become that, but he made a mistake, as you and I both know, and suggested that we have a mineral mines tax. Well, that was a red flag to some of the corporate bodies of this state, and Mr. Dixon was removed.
Now, there's a connection between the Missoula Mercantile Company and the Anaconda Company?
No, there never was a direct connection there, except, yes, there is a connection in a way, the history shows. I suppose you could say Marcus Daly was very active, and Marcus Daly was the Anaconda Company. Marcus Daly owned one-third of an interest in the Missoula Mercantile Company, and it was not known until I dissolved the company in the late 1950s and early 60s, and found to my chagrin that he did have a one-third interest.
And so, I remember as a young person in the Flathead Valley, the Kalispell Mercantile.
That's right.
That was the KM.
And the Kalispell Mercantile, Kalispell Grocery, and the Kalispell Feed and Grain, they were all belonged. And then there was some land down near DeMarsville that the company owned. And they had some other land
But the Kalispell Mercantile and the other businesses you mentioned were owned by the Missoula Mercantile.
100%.
And did the Missoula Mercantile have commercial enterprises in other communities too?
Oh, yes. They built Western Montana, and that's a story all of itself. They built the main store here, then they built stores down in Hamilton and Stevensville and Frenchtown and Arlee, St. Ignatius, and Ronan, and also in Polson, and they went as far as Troy. Now, they did something else, Bob. They built banks in those towns, and I remember when I went to work for the Missoula Mercantile Company in spring of 1948, the Missoula Mercantile Company was at that point dissolving themselves or moving away from that phase of it, and my job was to go out and get rid of those banks. And we sold them generally to the people who'd been running the banks for them. You have a matter, you're familiar with the Olson people up at
Ronan? Yeah.
Well, the Olson.
The banking family.
Well, banking family. But that was a Missoula Mercantile Company bank.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And that, along with the bank in St. Ignatius, it was the same everywhere.
Now, Marcus Daly, of course, died near the turn of the century, but you mentioned he owned a third of the Missoula Mercantile Company. Did his heirs then inherit that, and is that what you dissolved in 1950, or did the Anaconda Company?
No, his heirs, and he had no heirs except a lady who is the sole heir of the whole dynasty of Marcus Daly. Marcus Daly III, who went to school here in the 1950s at the university, was divorced and married a girl in Las Vegas. She'd been a stripper. And Marcus Daly died, Marcus Daly III died, and when he did, this was the last of the line, And so she was the beneficiary of that interest in the Missoula Mercantile Company.
Oh.
And she's a lady that's been on the board of the foundation board out here at the university through the years. She owns that little island up in Flathead Lake.
Oh, I think I remember that, yeah.
Dream Isle, or yeah, such as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Comes up in the summers to enjoy it.
I remember when I was a state legislator that there was some kind of a legislative conference in Las Vegas. And I don't remember exactly when this was, but that some of the Montana legislators were invited over to the home of Marcus Daly III, and he might still have been living, or perhaps the widow was. But I think the connection was to the University of Montana, you know, the foundation.
He probably was still living at that time, Bob.
This would have been maybe in the late 70s.
That would be all right. He would still be there because he died in about 84, 85.
I see. Well, you know, then Governor Erickson was replaced by, there was a kind of a funny series there. It was Elmer
very
Holt,
peculiar.
Frank Cooney, and until Roy Ayers became governor. Do you have any recollections of any of that?
Oh, yes. And remember that Erickson opted to go to the United States Congress. And when he did, that moved somebody else up from the vice governor, so to speak.
That was Frank Cooney.
And that was Cooney moved up. Now, Cooney was not elected. Can't remember. Cooney got sick and died.
Yeah.
And so then the powers that be, and these are the Anaconda Company, Montana Power, railroads, oil companies, farm union, labor, everybody, pretty well got together. And Elmer Holt, who had been in the Senate and was Bob Corrett's father-in-law,
yes,
was put in as the interim governor.
And I think Elmer Holt was the president pro tem of the Senate.
That was what he was.
And so he became governor. And of course, Bob Corrett was an important official in the Montana Power Company and an attorney.
He was the attorney for the Montana Power Company, okay. And his brother Jack was the president of the Montana Power Company.
And it was your impression that that Elmer Holt was agreeable to the
That's what
the key players in Montana politics.
Most of them, yes, at that time, because after Erickson had opted to get out and Cooney was there for a short term. Remember, this was in the middle of the Depression.
Yes, yeah.
And Montana was in a turmoil. We had the IWW people out of Plentywood in that area that were raising thunder. And we had the people in Butte who were threatening to strike every other day. And whoever they got in as governor came there, I think, on a consensus more than normal. Yes. And Elmer Holt was that type of fellow. He was a Republican, as I recall. Because in those days, you'd know better than I, but the Republicans pretty well dominated the political scene.
But I think maybe in the 30s, that wasn't so much the case. Wasn't Elmer Holt a pretty conservative Democrat?
He could have been a Democrat for all I know, yes.
I think he was a pretty conservative Democrat.
That could have been it, and that was probably the reason that there was the consensus on him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, the whole state changed from the old Republican base to Democrat during the Depression. There was no question about that, and of course, Franklin D. Roosevelt became our hero.
Yeah, and your dad was a county official in Flathead County during that period of time, and elected county sheriff in Flathead County in 1934.
He was first, he was elected first as county treasurer and later as assessor and then sheriff.
Ty, there was a fella that I remember hearing about who was quite a prominent legislator from our part of the state, from the northwestern part of the state. In the 20s and 30s, in fact, he was associated as an ally of Governor Joe Dixon, who we mentioned a little earlier in our conversation. His name was Bob Pauline.
Bob Pauline, yes.
Yeah, do you have any recollection of him? I think he ran a laundry or dry cleaners or something in Kalispell, but he was a state senator and a fairly prominent one for a long time.
He really was, and he had a little ranch right south of Kalispell. Yes, he was a lone senator. That was in the days when one senator represented each county.
Yeah.
I remember the name of Pauline, yes. When I was in high school, we were very active with the agricultural people. We had, I don't know whether it was the 4-H or what it is, whatever you might claim. A man by the name of Kaufman kind of headed up that department. And as a matter of fact, this is aside, but they took over the gym for the agricultural people. And as a consequence, Flathead County High School had no gymnasium.
Holy smokes.
And I happened to have been on a basketball team at that time, and at 3 o'clock every day, we had to get in the car and drive to Whitefish, and practice in their gym under the eyes of Mr. Hinderman.
Oh, no.
The old cagey man. So we could never beat Whitefish in the
night. Because they knew all your plays.
Well, anytime we ever got ahead of Hindi, the lights would go out in the gym for a matter of 5 or 10 minutes to break our momentum.
Is that right?
Oh, Hindi was...
Well, boy, there was a lot of competition, I know, between Whitefish and Kalispell.
Oh, there was. Well, it came about because Kalispell became the county seat instead of Whitefish. And
Whitefish was on the railroad.
And then, yes, Kalispell had the railroad at first, and then they decided that they'd rather go the other route and went through Whitefish instead of going out west of Kalispell. The original route, you know, came through Kalispell and was going up through Wolf Creek and that area, so forth. But back to where we were, Bob Pauline was a power in the Senate. There wasn't any question about it. And I can remember my dad talking about it, and other politicians that I, at that time, I was just becoming aware of what politics was, but I know that he was, in my mind, rather outstanding at the time, along with Ori Armstrong, who was also well-respected, a Republican that served for many years.
Speaking of the House at one time?
He was in the House, and he had been in World War I. So he was very strong with the veterans groups, and he was a leader of the veterans.
Gurney Moss?
Gurney Moss was an outstanding senator from Whitefish. I had the opportunity when I first went to lobby at the legislature to work with him, and since he knew my father very well, he kind of took me under his wing. Many times I'd get ready in the morning to have breakfast in the Placer Hotel where he lived, and usually held court after the session was over out in the lobby. And he'd come in and sit down and visit with me and said, "You look worried." And I said, "I am." "Well, don't worry. Everything's going to be all right." He says, "As a matter of fact, that bill you're worrying about, I wouldn't even go up there today and appear on it." I said, "You wouldn't?" "No." He said, "Senator Robinson and I will take care of that."
That was Fred Robinson.
Fred Robinson from Malta, for whom we named the Great Bridge.
Yes.
Yes. And those were the days when the Senate was pretty well organized in one party.
And that would have probably been in the late 40s, I'm thinking?
Coming in the late 40s, 50s, starting in the 50s. I went to the legislature to lobby under Bill Jamison, who was presumably my boss.
Who became a federal judge.
Yes.
Lives in Billings, was a prominent attorney. In fact, I think he was president of the National Bar Association at one time.
He was one of the few presidents we ever had of the National Bar. He was given all the highest honors the National Bar could award him.
Now, Ty, he lobbied for the
railroads.
All of them?
All of them.
The Northern Pacific, the Milwaukee, the Great Northern.
There were seven different railroads at the time.
Union Pacific, yeah. And so you went as an understudy of his.
That is correct.
How did you happen to get that job?
Well, how did I?
Yeah.
Our office represented the Milwaukee Railroad from the time Milwaukee entered Montana. And Jameson's office represented the Northern Pacific.
That's your office here in Missoula.
Yes.
So you'd graduated from law school, and you were a young attorney then.
That is right. I graduated in 1948 and went to work for the Missoula Merc as its in-house counsel. And 6 years later, I joined up to the law firm that had been in existence here since 1877.
And what firm is that?
Garlington, Lawn and Robinson is the name of the present firm. It was early on, it was Murphy, Garlington, and Pauley.
I see. That's when it was when you affiliated with it?
Yes. Yeah. And Mr. Pauley and Mr. Murphy both died the same year. So Garlington and Sherman Lawn and I organized the present firm. And I, at that time, we represented the Anaconda Company, represented Montana Power. That firm represented most all the sawmills of western Montana, represented many banks. We were a corporate firm, so to speak, in that respect. And I was tapped to go over and be there part of the time in the legislature because Mr. Jameson and Mr. Newell Goff, Newell Goff represented the Great Northern Railroad.
Okay, and he was an attorney in Helena.
Yes, he was in the firm of Weir, Goff, and Booth, which exists there today. And the three of us constituted the Montana Railroad Association. Then one morning, Mr. Jameson called me and said, be leaving here before noon today. President Eisenhower has nominated me to be a federal judge, and so I have resigned as a lobbyist, and I'm going back to Billings and take over.
Wow.
And from that day on, I did, and I had the fortune to hire John Willard and John Delano, John Connors, whom you know, that
yes.
is an attorney.
Yeah.
And I had the benefit of a boy by the name of Arthur Lamy, who was an attorney down in the big firm in Billings. And Arthur and John read the bills, and I kind of spent my time up on the hill.
Now, Ty, your father was a Democrat.
Yes.
You were probably raised more or less a Democrat.
No, I really can't. My family was a dysfunctional one. My mother was a Theodore Roosevelt Republican. My father is kind of a Jeffersonian by our terms today.
Sure. Where I was going with that is that I know sometimes lobbying teams have a fellow that kind of specializes with the Democrats and a guy that kind of specializes
yes.
with the Republicans, and I wondered whether you were the designated Democrat. That was the question I was going
to ask. No, really, I think it turned out finally, Bob, I was kind of a eunuch. People used to ask me, what are you, a Democrat or Republican? Brother Cal, my brother in Kalispell, who was a lawyer, was a Democrat.
Yes.
And he, until a couple years before his death, he decided that he got mad at him for some reason. But be that as it may, I suppose I have been more over on the Republican side most of my life because I was representing corporate activity. I was representing the business side of and I became president of the Montana Chamber of Commerce in 1963, which is purely a business-oriented organization. So I'd say that I would on that. But you're right. We hired people in our lobby purposely. Were they Democrats or Republicans for that very purpose?
Yeah.
We wanted a Republican to come and lobby you. We wouldn't let John Lahr come over and do it. I had John for a few years there.
Well, John, who most of us remember, was a lobbyist for Montana Power Company, was also a lobbyist for the railroads.
He was
then.
To begin with. What John was doing, he was a call boy down here in the Northern Pacific Railroad.
Here in Missoula?
Mm-hmm. Call these fellas out for their jobs in the morning, and I had come to know John through, he was a debater in high school here, and I sat in as a judge one time, and I was impressed with John. So I talked to him, and sure enough, he married Leroy Anderson's daughter, and you'll remember Leroy Anderson was a outstanding senator in the Democratic Party and
also a congressman at one time.
Yes, he was. That's right. Went to Congress after he represented really eastern Montana when we had the two congressmen. That is true.
Now, Ty, as a lobbyist, you saw the lobbying operation of the Anaconda Company.
That I did.
There's some kind of I guess I've kind of gotten mixed reports in this, that I've heard that there was a rivalry between the Montana Power Company and that there was a close relationship and alliance between the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company. And perhaps both of those are partly true. Could you shed any light on that?
Both are true, because the Anaconda Company really owned the Montana Power Company until 1948, when their interest had to be divested. And the part that they owned in it was all moved over into the open public, and the public at that time bought Montana Power stock, which was no longer belonged to Anaconda Company. Yes, but during the legislature, they worked very rather closely together. The Anaconda Company had outstanding lobbyists. A man by the name of Wilkinson usually was there. Al Wilkinson was their top lobbyist. Bill Kirkpatrick later came along to be a fine lobbyist. They had several people who lived in Butte, all of them came out of Butte, maybe. Once in a while, they would have maybe somebody from their Great Falls operation, but normally mostly all Butte. And it's true that what you said, both sides of that coin are available to us. There was at times some contests that might arise where the Anaconda Company might benefit from a bill that was in that would hurt the Montana Power, I'm sure. But I think they all managed to get together. You must remember that The Anaconda Company had the largest, probably, room in the Placer Hotel, what we call those rooms.
Watering holes.
Watering holes later.
Yeah.
They were all there. The railroads had one, and I operated that. The labor people had one. The truckers had one. The insurance people had one. And the Montana Power had one. But the Anaconda people really had the large one because they fed the, every day after the session was over, you'd find the delegates from the Butte, Anaconda, Deer Lodge, and maybe one or two other neighboring counties, people from the Boulder area. They would all be up there getting fed at night, and that was expected. They may vote against the Anaconda Company the next day, but they didn't. But the people who worked for the Anaconda Company had been elected to the legislature. And the history of that was, it, if there was a tough bill against the Anaconda Company, you'd find many of those delegates in the bathroom at the time the vote came up. So those legislators, particularly in the House, and at that time I think Butte must have had four, apparently, and I think Anaconda had at least two. Red Menahan was there forever, as was Joe Quillacy, you know, from Butte.
Yeah.
You're familiar, very, they're friends of yours.
Do you remember a fellow named Mervyn Dempsey?
Yes.
Back in the 1950s?
He came from Butte. He was rather a heavy set fella. I'd say he must have weighed 250 pounds easily. Rather, I don't think he was over maybe 5'9". Yes. Mervyn was one of the group fighters. And in the Butte delegation often...
One of what group?
The Butte delegation, you would find once in a while some labor people.
Yeah.
Labor agents. And that's what Mervyn was mainly.
I see.
And so there were things that came up for labor at times that could hurt the Anaconda Company, and there'd be a little infighting within the group, within the entire delegation.
Was it your impression that the Anaconda Company tried to cooperate to some extent with organized labor?
They did.
Did they have an interest in doing that?
Yes, they did. They sat down, and prior to the time that Jim Murray was the head, there was a man here from Missoula, I can't think of his name at the moment, that was head of AFL-CIO labor. They had difficulty working with him, of course.
Jim Umber?
Jim Umber. You're right. Yeah. You're correct. You're right on it. Your mind's better than mine. That's the fella. And
he was more open to working with the Anaconda Company?
More open than Jim Murray by far.
Yeah.
Well, in those days, they recognized that labor wasn't going to ultimately win all the time because the politics, I think, of Montana was heavily against labor in some areas, particularly in the eastern areas of Montana. Butte, Anaconda, Missoula, Great Falls were probably the main labor spots, and then eventually, through the years, we've seen Billings and Bozeman and Kalispell.
But it sounds like the fellows that hung out on a more or less regular basis there at the Anaconda Company hospitality room tended to be people from the Butte and Anaconda area.
100%.
And did you ever encounter other legislators from other areas there?
Yes. Great Falls people were there once in a while, Great Falls Democrats. They'd mostly all be Democrats. You wouldn't find many Republicans up there at their room. But there would be some because they would invite them. Each room had its different decor. For instance, in the room that I had for the railroad, we invited the husbands and wives to come.
I see.
And we were very genteel about this. We would have, yes, whatever they wanted in the way of an imbibement, and we might have little nice hors d'oeuvres. But we closed our room, well, by 6 at the latest, 6:30. But those other rooms might run on until 8:30, 9 at night.
So I think what I hear you saying, Ty, is that you might have you might have had more Republicans than Democrats at yours. There were more Democrats than Republicans at the Anaconda Company one. Maybe the insurance companies had a different mix.
A mixture. The trucking companies likewise. Most of the trucking companies I'd say you'd have. Well, they'd selected people that they might invite.
So you couldn't just drop in?
To their place, I don't think you could just drop in. Leonard Eckel was the man that was
lobbying. The lobbyist for the truckers.
The truckers, yep. And at that time, Leonard, I think, and a fine lobbyist, But I think they were prone to invite people to theirs.
So in your case, where the railroads were concerned, at the end of the legislature, it was known that you had a hospitality suite that was open to anybody who wanted to come
Absolutely.
Up along with their spouses.
Yep, anybody. Yeah. We did that because at first there weren't too many spouses that came with their hubbies, but as they did, they seemed to be left out, and in order to have some place to go. And in those days, Bob, believe it or not, the legislature, this is in the 50s and 60s mainly, the legislature was all done by 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Gosh, I just can't imagine.
You can't imagine it, can you?
No, I can't.
No. And lots of times it didn't get started until noon. But in those days, we didn't have the complexity of life that we have.
Yeah.
The culture was a little different.
The volume of legislation wasn't as great.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. And in those days, I should tell you that lobbyists served a purpose. As you're familiar with what lobbyists do and what purpose they serve. But there was one additional one. If a legislator wanted a bill put together, he'd talk to a lobbyist, and we'd put it together for him, having nothing to do with us, having nothing to do with why we were there.
In fact, I've been told, Ty, that you were someone who was especially gifted as a drafter of bills, and that you drafted a fair number of them.
I would say, I don't think I was gifted, Bob, but...
Experienced and
I
competent
was experienced
in doing that.
This was before we had the legislative council or people,
yeah.
The process today, which they take care of that. We did a lot of that, yes. And one of the faux pas that I pulled, Tom Haines, who was a legislator here from Missoula and a friend of yours,
yes.
Wanted to do something about getting, was it margarine? Yes, he wanted to get margarine so we could, right after World War II, so to speak.
I think, if I remember, there was something about, there was a law that said that margarine couldn't be sold if it was colored yellow.
That's
it had to be sold colored white, and then the lady could mix in the yellow coloring with it, and it looked kind of yucky when it was white.
Did you ever do that?
I don't remember it.
Oh,
but
we used to all have to do that with this little package of coloring, and you'd mix it all in to get it looking like butter. Yes.
And so the housewives, you know, in the grocery stores thought, well, why can't we just sell the stuff with the coloring in it? And I think the dairymen maybe didn't want that. I don't know who the opposition was, but I know that Governor Aronson was committed on one side of that, and I don't remember
that is
if he
correct.
And Haines were on opposite sides, perhaps
yep.
They were, but it was a hot controversy in the 1950s.
It was very hot. Well, Tom had to have a bill, so I, of course, put together a bill. What did I do? I copied a bill that had been used in Wyoming, and the only problem was I forgot to take out the word Wyoming. Down at the very last sentence.
Oh, no.
And it went all the way through to the governor's office.
And nobody caught it?
None of the clerks caught it. Nobody caught it except George O'Connor, later to become president of Montana Power, who was a lobbyist and a potent lobbyist for the Montana Power Company.
And a legislator prior to then.
Had for many years from Carbon County, had been a legislator, right. He called me and said that bill of yours, you know, is haywire, and he said it's in the governor's office, and he said, I just see it's not going to work. So he called me at night, and I got a hold of, I forget who was in the governor's office, and got him out of bed to tell him not to do anything in the morning, and I got a hold of that bill, and we took it back to a committee in the House where it had started, and I had to get that little thing stricken and get the word Montana corrected in there, and it took me a couple days to get it back through before I got it down to the governor. And I think the governor, that was Governor Bonner.
And now the railroads had no interest in this.
No, none whatsoever. Yeah. Well, there were many bills that I drew. But you
sounds like you took kind of an interest in it, though. It sounds like it. I mean, because...
I took a great interest. Yeah. And I felt that a lobbyist over there, in my part, was there to help every legislator, regardless. I learned immediately when I arrived from Bill Jamieson that as a lobbyist, you don't want to tell any legislator anything but the truth, and if you didn't know it, tell them you didn't know it. And with that standard, I stayed with the lobbying through 9 sessions of the legislature.
And certainly that was always your policy.
That was complete.
Yeah. Now, you know, we've mentioned Governor Bonner. Do you know, was there any relationship between Governor Bonner, say, and Al Wilkinson and the people who've been...
I'm not up to date as to how whether the companies, whether the power brokers, and so to speak, were involved in his election. He had come home from the war after World War II, and he was a war hero. And he was elected, and that's all I know. I had just arrived home after his election. He was elected in November, and I didn't get home until the following March. And likewise with Arnold Olson and others from the Democratic Party, they're... I don't really know, Bob.
Have a close working relationship with Bonner, particularly. He was governor just as you were starting out as a lobbyist.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He appointed my father to the State Board of Equalization, and I knew John Bonner, knew him well through the years. Bonner himself became a lobbyist in later years, you remember?
Okay, yes, I do, vaguely.
Mm-hmm.
You knew Governor Aronson?
Very well. I happen to know Governor Aronson because I had met Governor Erickson before either one of us ever got into this business. He was working up in the oil fields out of Cutbank, and I was a border patrolman out of Sweetgrass.
Really?
And we used to meet out around the oil wells where there was nothing else for the border patrolman to do, so I would be out there, and here would be this big man with something on each shoulder, a big, looked like a water jug, so to speak, which later turned out to be the thing that they pour down into the oil wells to blow things apart.
Oh, I see. Chemical of some kind.
It was a, I can't think of the name of the chemical, but you and I both know it, but it would, if he had dropped one of those, neither one of us would be, he wouldn't have been governor and I'd no longer been a lobbyist.
I'll be darned.
But that, and yes, I used to visit with him. And the thing about it, when he would shake hands with you, his hand was so big, it was just, yours was just lost in it. But I came to know Governor Berenson, his wife, and very well. Rose was a wonderful lady. And in those days, lobbyists were called into the governor's office just to visit with him, too. Maybe you'd have a half a dozen people there, not all lobbyists, but everyone else. He wanted to know about this, this, and this. And he was a man that, I take it, that made a judgment. Not particularly a political judgment. He made it from the seat of his pants. He was an uneducated man, you remember, third grade education at the most. And his judgments, as I look back on them, were really unequaled in many ways. So he was as a governor, in those days, we didn't have many problems, and the state had a good financial surplus. We didn't have the problems that had risen subsequently.
Do you remember, go ahead.
No.
Remember Governor Nutter?
Governor Nutter and I were in law school together.
Oh, really?
Yes. And then I went out and worked for Governor Nutter, and I had great faith in him, and I felt that he was going to be one of the great governors of Montana, certainly in my lifetime. And he was. He was an understandable governor. He and I, if I may just digress for a minute, I'm president of the State Chamber of Commerce. I happened to be in the Capitol on the day of January the 25th, which is my birthday. I left my office that morning and my secretary said, "Now you'll be sure and be back. You're getting back today, aren't you, from Helena?" And I said, "I'll be back. Probably get back here by 4:30 or 5 because I'll be all through over there by 2 o'clock. I was in with Frank Murray, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and I got a call to come down to the governor's office. And Nutter told me that he was going to Cutbank that night to make a talk, and he'd been trying to get a hold of me, and as president of the state chamber, he wanted me to make a little talk ahead of him. Could I take 10 minutes to make a talk? Well, I said, "I'll find out, because I have a commitment back in Missoula that I'm supposed to be doing something there, and I'm not quite sure, but I'll find out." Don and I went and talked to my colleagues. I got a hold of my friend, partner Sherm Law, and he said, "Ty, there's a great big surprise birthday party for you tonight at the Florence Hotel. We've got about 150 people coming to that party for you. You got to be here." So I went back and told the governor of my situation, and he said, "Well, I really need you up there, but if that's the case, I guess." And we all know what happened to that airplane ride that night.
What a story.
So the angel was on my shoulder.
Oh, was that ever the case?
And I felt so very bad because Don and I were good friends. He and I had refereed some basketball games after World War II. He was a good referee, and we both refereed a state tournament in Butte. First time I really worked with him, and I got to know him then pretty well.
How would you describe him?
He was a dynamic and a rather forceful fella, and I think once he made up his mind, this was going to be it. And he felt that he was right. He was a senator from his county over there in Richland County in eastern Montana, and he was very vocal in the Senate. He wasn't afraid to stand up. By that time he had graduated from law school, had a legal training, but he was rather an outspoken spokesman for the Republican Party in the Senate. A very fine fellow to visit with, to get along, a great and good friend.
Good sense of humor?
Excellent sense of humor, excellent. That's what I think kept him going. But
now, how did he and Tim Babcock happen to run as a team?
Well, you have to remember Tim Babcock came out of Glendive, and Richland County being the neighbor to Glendive, I suppose that they had become friends. Tim was in business in Miles City, but they were both young Republicans, active in the, and that would be the only way that I would say, Bob, that they had probably become well acquainted.
How would you compare them? How were they similar? How were they different?
Well, rather much different. Tim Babcock is, as we know, a laid-back fella. It seems to me Tim Babcock has about 9 lives. He gets into some of the worst jackpots a politician get into, or anybody, a human being, but he always lands on his feet. Now, Don was more pragmatic. And as a governor, I think he was, well, pretty well organized. And I'm sure that maybe, I'd have to say at times, the people working around Tim Babcock were organized, but Tim wasn't always organized. Tim was a great friend of humanity. I remember being in Governor Nutter's office one day and trying to get some money for Western Montana roads, and he was telling me, he said, you know, that's great to talk about that. He said, there's only so much money, and I have to make a decision here. And the people up in Plentywood, northeastern Montana, they haven't had their roads fixed for 18 years. And he said, you have a man by the name of Harry Bell who's been on the State Highway Committee, and he's been getting money practically every session of the Congress for something Western Montana. So he said, I'm telling you, I'm going to help those people over in northeastern Montana. Now, had that been Tim, Tim would say, well, let's see what we can do. We only have so much money. Maybe we'll divide it and give them a little, and so they can get started, and we'll give you a little. That was the difference that I would see. Their personalities were different, but they were the same in that they were happy-go-lucky fellas in the end, both of them. Nutter was really a happy-go-lucky fella. He'd been through the war, and I think his experiences were no different than Tim Babcock, who you remember was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Yes, yeah. Tim was a combat infantryman. In fact, I'm going to interview him too, I think.
Good.
And what the story I remember, and I'm dying to ask him about this, is that after the war was over, somehow he met General Eisenhower. Eisenhower was no longer president, and Tim was just a new governor of Montana. And they met at a golf course at some golf...
I see.
Some, I think, a fundraising event on a golf course. And they had an opportunity to talk a little bit, and Eisenhower was fascinated that Tim was a buck private, you know, just an enlisted man in the infantry in Europe during World War II. And he said, I'd like to visit with you about that. I'd just like to kind of understand how the war looked from your viewpoint, because it was very different than mine. And so apparently Tim spent a long weekend at the Gettysburg farm of General Eisenhower back sometime in the early 1960s, and I'm dying to ask him about that. So
I want to get a hold of Tim. As I was boarding an airplane the other day down in Palm Springs, a man behind me heard me say something to somebody about Montana, and he said, you live in Montana? I told him I did, and he said, do you know people in Montana? I said, I'm fairly well knowledgeable. Yes, we don't have too many people in the state. He said, would you happen to know a fellow by the name of Tim Babcock? And it turned out that he was a partner in the Battle of the Bulge right alongside of Tim as a buck private. And he said, we went to the 50th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge together over there, and he said, that's the last time I've seen Tim. He said, I understand he's still alive and healthy. I said, he very much is. I think Tim is a doer and a goer.
Oh, he's remarkable.
Isn't he?
He's really remarkable. He goes to the Kiwanis Club meetings and the Pachyderm Club meetings every week regularly, and always has a spring in his step and a sparkle in his eye. He's a great guy, that's for sure. You know, now and you obviously knew him as governor and have an impression of him. Then he was followed by Governor Anderson. Any
fraternity brother of mine.
Really,
another very good friend, but I'd have to say this. He isn't here. He's dead, and I don't think lightning will strike me, but Forrest Anderson was a good governor. He was well organized, and he was a fine political governor in the sense that he hewed very close to the line. You were in the legislature at the time. You knew what kind of a governor you were dealing with. But he was the kind of a man that said, I'm going to do something, and you'd say, you can't do that, Governor. That's illegal. So he was telling you that he was going to do something illegally, but he was being honest about his illegality. And I used to tell him that, because I was on the board of the Montana Power Company, as was Bob Corrett, his good friend, and he'd get after both of us about wanting to buy a piece of land up in Canyon Ferry, up near Wolf Creek. We said we couldn't do anything. Montana Power owned that land, and we, neither one of us, could deal on that with your governor. We were sorry. He said, I'll get it. And eventually,
and you obviously knew him as governor and have an impression of him. Then he was followed by Governor Anderson. Any
fraternity brother of mine.
Really,
another very good friend, but I'd have to say this. He isn't here. He's dead, and I don't think lightning will strike me, but Forrest Anderson was a good governor. He was well organized, and he was a fine political governor in the sense that he hewed very close to the line. You were in the legislature at the time. You knew what kind of a governor you were dealing with. But he was the kind of a man that said, I'm going to do something, and you'd say, you can't do that, Governor. That's illegal. So he was telling you that he was going to do something illegally, but he was being honest about his illegality. And I used to tell him that, because I was on the board of the Montana Power Company, as was Bob Corrett, his good friend, and he'd get after both of us about wanting to buy a piece of land up in Canyon Ferry, up near Wolf Creek. We said we couldn't do anything. Montana Power owned that land, and we, neither one of us, could deal on that with your governor. We were sorry. He said, I'll get it. And eventually, we found that the power company did make a sale of land, made it to his brother-in-law.
Oh, I see.
And then his brother-in-law deeded it to Forrest.
Why would that have been illegal for him to buy it?
Not illegal, but it was illegal for us on the power company board.
Oh.
We're right in the middle of the legislature.
I see.
And it's during, when we were there, there's a couple of lobbyists.
It just seemed improper to you.
Well, it was highly unethical, we felt.
Sure, yeah, I see.
But it didn't bother Forrest.
I see. I mean, it could have been interpreted if you'd given him too good a deal as
He was a highly political man. I had a young man working for me who had been a senator from Drummond years ago, very active with the American Legion and others, but he was a Democrat, and Forrest wanted to appoint him to the state labor commissioner, I believe it is, the job. And the minute somebody stood up in the Senate and said, wait a minute, he's lobbying for the railroads. He's lobbying for those people there for, and we don't want anybody like that. And the next thing I knew, I got a call to go down to the governor's office, and he said, I want to tell you, I like your boy very much, but I'm not going to appoint him. I'm pulling back the appointment. And I don't want you to do anything about his job if you want to keep him and so forth. But it was strictly political with Forrest. He was he's a wheeler and dealer. But a good governor in the sense that the state ran well. We didn't have many problems, but he was a strong political man in the sense that he was a Democrat all the way through.
Now, and he defeated Tim Babcock.
Yes.
And then didn't run for re-election, and he was followed by Governor Tom Judge.
That's right.
And Judge was the first governor to be governor entirely under the new Constitution.
I think that's right, Bob. I think you're absolutely correct.
The transition, I think, took place during Governor Anderson's term in office.
You think you're right. I can remember that time because I served on the Constitutional Commission Committee that we spent about 7 months ahead of that time preparing information for the Constitutional Convention. Yes. A man by the name of Gene Mahoney had been a previous senator, as you know,
from
Sanders County, was the chairman of that commission. Mm-hmm. And I think we had Forrest in one day to talk to us on matters of, it wasn't education, but something else, I can't recall. Yes, you're right, I think he was the governor.
Now, did you lobby for several sessions after the new Constitution?
Yes, I did.
Did you notice any particular differences or anything? I mean, I think maybe the differences have become more apparent, you know, as time's gone on. But any thoughts on that? Any perspective on that?
Well, I don't know whether it was the new Constitution that did it, but we more or less phased out the watering holes, and I think maybe we were looking at things in an ethical way more than anything else, perhaps, when we closed them eventually, finally, altogether. And we were a little more hesitant about taking you legislators out to lunch or dinner in the evening. And I think the legislators became a little more reserved and standoffish to the point where they are today. I think they're very reserved on it. I think it was a slow-moving change in culture. I don't know where that came about because of the change of that led. Well, the one change we saw as lobbyists was the phase in the legislature, that statement having to do with the environment, free and open environment for all of Montana. And if you were in the utility business or you were in the business of natural resource, and remember the railroads were, so that would be the biggest change I saw. Probably came about there.
A greater emphasis on environmental protection.
Yes.
You'd associate with the new Constitution.
For instance, we had in the sawmills in western Montana what we call teepee burners. You were familiar with those,
yes,
where they burned the refuse after they had gone through the mill and so forth. And we had.
Or just a big cone shaped kind of a.
That's what it was. Looked like a teepee.
Like a teepee. And they were filled with bark and chips and branches and that sort of thing from sawdust, I guess, from the sawmill.
That is exactly what.
And then they just, that refuse, that mill waste, that wood waste, would just smolder and burn in there and would give off a certain amount of smoke. And at night, I can remember, you could see them glowing at night. When I was a young person in the Flathead Valley, there were a lot of teepee burners up there. And so the reason they were controversial was because of air quality, is that right?
That is correct. They were polluters. And if your wife hung out your laundry on the line, you might find it very well speckled with all the little residue of the carbon that was being burned out. Yes, that was one change that came about from our sawmills here in western Montana. Well, no question about that. And we set up committees to study air pollution. And the first committee that we had in Missoula County, I happened to be the chairman. And people couldn't understand how that could happen. How could I be a chairman when we represented all these sawmills? But we saw the necessity of health being a premier factor in our lives. And if these things were, such as the teepee burners, were unhealthy, then something had to be done about it. And then the next phase was the big pulp mill we had here in Missoula. And that was set up in 1959. In 72, 13 years later, these changes came about. The pollution that we smelled in Missoula, usually every morning, finally came to an end. Mainly and only frequently, maybe two or three times a year, may we still have a little of that, but it was necessary for operations like that mill to put in the necessary scrubbers to take care of that type of odor and the pollution, and they've done it. And that, I think, is the direct result of the 1972 change in our law.
In the Constitution.
In the Constitution.
We've talked about the corporations in Montana and how they were involved back in the 1940s and 50s. And I've been, you know, curious, too, because I guess I thought that the hospitality rooms were more of a melting pots where you had Democrats and Republicans and maybe even a few liberals sprinkled in with the conservatives who would get together and just shoot the bull at the end of the day. And I hadn't realized that they were, you might have separate groups going back to separate places each time. Now, the 1972 Constitution went into effect, and these laws we talked about, you know, that were designed to protect the environment, easily passed the legislature and were signed by the governor. You'd think back in the 40s and 50s, back when there was less concern about the environment and perhaps the influence of the corporations in the state was greater, that those bills wouldn't have had a chance of passing. Do you think that's accurate?
That is 100% accurate. In my opinion, back in those days, there hadn't been the public concern, public esteem for environment as it existed. We were moving out of our wilderness area, so to speak, of the development of the time that we were developing Montana. We were a heavy natural resource state in the 40s.
Well, why was it that the Anaconda Company, the Montana Power Company, the railroads, and so on, had lost enough of their political clout by the 1970s that they weren't able to stop that legislation from passing? Or did they just think, well, maybe this is in the public interest and we might as well kind of reluctantly go along with it?
Well, it was the latter is pretty close to that, because we had several bills, and some of them were very rather extreme environmental bills. One by a Representative Flynn from Missoula County here had been put in and was getting more attention than people thought, as some people thought it should. And then there were a couple more moderate bills put in, and finally it was the Anaconda Company itself that went down and suggested to Tim Babcock it would be better to sign this bill, because obviously if you vetoed this bill in any way, the next session we might get one, we as corporate polluters, so to speak, or people in that business, in the mining business, we might get something more drastic. And that was really the key point. I know that is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So you were right in that the time had come for people to say, yes, well, maybe we're better off to take this. But back in the 40s, 50s, and in the first part of the early 60s, it was difficult.
The corporations wouldn't have had to compromise on much of anything then if they didn't want to.
Normally not, because they had pretty good control of the legislature.
Now, Ty, I've heard that, but I'm curious to know how that worked.
Were you ever acquainted with a man by the name of Boo McGilvery?
Yes.
Boo was an assessor in Polson, Lake County, and he was hired by the Montana Power Company to be their tax advisor on real property that they owned throughout the state. And he had counterparts with a lot of companies, and the Anaconda Company was one. I know the Farm Union had their people out, but Boo's entire 365-year day job was to go out and get legislators lined up to run and get them elected. And then I think in the late 40s, 50s.
Now, this 50s, was after he had been assessor in
yes.
County?
He went to work for the power company in about 1944, I think it was.
And had he not been a state senator, too, from Lake County?
Yes, he had.
In my mind, he had.
He had.
So what he'd do is he'd travel. He was an employee, a full-time employee for the Montana Power
Company. That's right.
And he would just travel around the state, and he'd try to talk fellas into running for the legislature.
Trying to get candidates lined up and help. And if they would run, then he'd see to it that they got help. In those days, the money matter was not what it is today as far as a matter of concern, probably. Anyway, he'd see to it that people in the community got behind this candidate and got elected. And when that candidate arrived, Boo and similar people, the telephone company, and the other utilities, all were very concerned about getting their own people in there. Let's take an example. There were some trucking bills in the early 50s, 59 session, that the truckers certainly didn't like. And what did they do? In the next two or three sessions, you found a lot of truckers elected to the legislature.
Yeah.
They were going to take care of that. Remember Harry Northey and the rest of them? They were the type of people that were going to see to it that that didn't happen again.
So the people that Boo McGilvray might have recruited to run for the legislature generally would, because you know we hear about the Anaconda Company being this colossus of all
colossus.
The power in the legislature, but McGilvray worked for the Montana Power Company.
That's right.
But
Wilkinson and Denny Shea from the Anaconda Company were out doing the same thing. And those legislators arrived, did they feel beholden to them? No, but they knew that they had a friend there that would help them if they needed. I can't recall the session, but it seemed to me that the Senate was tied up almost even Steven, and they were having quite a time trying to get organized. And finally, I know that Al Wilkinson was called in to sit down, and George O'Connor from the Montana Power Company, and the local manager of the telephone company, Red Hair, was his name. I mean, he's statewide for the telephone company at that time, to sit down to talk to these people, because they'd reached a point of desperation, probably. How were they going to do this? And those three fellas helped him. Now that's here's the top of the lobbying for the Montana Power and lobbying for the Anaconda and the telephone company. And I know that they held those sessions, and finally everything was decided how they were going to do it and who was going to be in charge, who was going to be the president pro tem of the Senate, and who was going to be such and such. And
were legislators involved in the meetings?
Yes, legislators were all there.
But these corporate officials were there in the same room at the same time.
Exactly.
Helping them figure out what they were going to do.
Because I got a call and I was supposed to have been there.
Now, was it just the Republican Party?
No, it was both. Because Wilkinson himself was a Democrat. Good Irish Democrat.
And so this meeting would have taken place like just in a large room, guys just sitting around talking it over and figuring out what to do.
That's exactly what they were going to do, how to get themselves organized to get underway. This was, the second day of the legislative session, and they couldn't get organized. They were having difficulty. And as I recall, it was almost a tie of both Democrats and Republicans. But they were there. Both their leaders were there, as I recall, from both parties.
Where did the AFL-CIO and the Farmers Union fit into this?
They would fit...
they weren't involved in that meeting.
No, they were not. Not as I recall that.
Were they an effective opposition to the Anaconda Company, the Montana Power Company, and the railroads, and that sort of thing?
To begin with, in the 50s, I didn't think the AFL-CIO was that effective, no. They didn't get the legislation they wanted. But the Farm Union was a little more... eager to work with some of those people to get some things they needed, and it really didn't bother the Anaconda or the Montana Power, because this is agricultural out here, and we have to have agriculture running, and the railroads certainly wanted agriculture to be dominant in their own field. In that connection, I should tell you, Bob, in the days of before we had many of the bureaucracy setups that we have in Helena now to determine what might happen the next 2 years after the legislature goes home, the finance and claims chairman was a man by the name of Senator James from up at Chester.
David James.
And a man by the name of Bill Groff, finance and claims.
From down here in
Ravalli County. And Morris Nichols, who was the chairman of appropriations, also from Ravalli County.
Right.
And a couple of others would sit, and they would call in various people, including me, to say, Can you railroad people tell us what your people back in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Chicago, and elsewhere have determined what we might have in the way of crops coming up? What kind of crops will we have for the next 2 years? What kind of an economy will agriculture have out there? And I had to supply that information, which the railroads had.
Yeah.
They had it. Now, that in the days before we had state government making those same determinations.
And but you honestly provided the best information you could, and that was a basis, I imagine, for trying to make some kind of budget projection.
Exactly. That was the purpose of it. And I know that others were called in for the same. The oil people. The oil lobbyists were in there. I remember they were coming in after I'm on my way out to do the same thing to get, and they had all of those things spoke to the economy. And that's the way that the legislature determined their budget. It was a little different in later years, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. Well, I got there at the end of that. I can remember Bill Groff carrying the little torn pieces of paper.
Yeah.
He'd just have a piece of stationery, and he'd tear a piece of it up into about eight pieces, and he'd have numbers written on each one, and you'd go up to him in the hallway and say, "Bill, I've got a question about the budget. Can you tell me about how much we expect to spend on the highway department? Because what I'm trying to do is see if we can jar loose some money for a overpass up near Whitefish or something other like that." You know, if I had a question like that.
Sure.
And he'd say, "Well, just a minute, let me see, Bob." And he'd reach in his pocket and he'd dig out the papers, and we'd sit down and he'd shuffle them around. He'd take out his ballpoint pen and, you know, do some calculating and that sort of thing. And I'd ask him some more specific questions, and he'd say, "Well, I don't hardly see how we can do that." Or, "Well, yeah, I think we might be able to do that. Why don't you talk to so-and-so, you know?" And he would make important decisions just, you know, standing in the hallway when he'd be talking to us. And we didn't have the computers. We didn't have the spreadsheets. We didn't have the complexities. We didn't have all the cooks involved in making the broth. Most of us just trusted whatever Bill had written down on that piece of paper. And there were a few guys looking over his shoulder. I think Bill Birchie and Matt Imsel and Norris Nichols and, you know, a few others. No doubt Dave James. But they were trusted. And it seemed to work pretty well.
It did work.
Then later on, of course, we got the computers involved in the process, and we hired, I think, Chase Econometrics at one time, and I don't remember, but there may have been other economic forecasting organizations. They helped us to have a professional way of understanding what was going to happen in the future, which hasn't always been accurate either. And we've had special sessions to balance the budget, but I do remember the end of that. And I remember it fondly.
No, that's right. Bill was all powerful in that respect, I'd say. But he was—he tried honestly, and in those days, just as you did, you knew you were elected to come and run the government of the state of Montana. And you know, we've had term limits and other things that I think now bear on that, where inexperienced people there are having some difficulty.
Now, Ty, you know, because of term limits, I think it's difficult for legislators to attain a high level of prominence that where a legislator in the relatively short amount of time in which they have to serve now, which is 8 years, they probably don't become, you know, like a political legend in Montana.
That's
but
right.
You served with some pretty important people, pretty distinguished.
Let's mention Dave Manning, longtime senator from over in eastern Montana. And a man that had been there long enough to know that he was elected to serve the public. Why? And he was part of the Democratic Party. But those men, you could ask them questions and get direct answers as to whether this was right or wrong, so far as their manner of thinking was concerned. There were a lot of those people in the past that I wish I had my little books that I've maintained all the years of each year. Do you remember the little roster book that's put out, to think back to some of the giants that we had. Yes?
Jim Lucas.
Outstanding lawyer from over in Miles City. And I must confess, I feel guilty every time I mention his name. He too was in law school here with me. But we convinced Jim that the time had come in Montana that we needed a sales tax. And he was going to run for governor. So he ran for governor, and we all know what happened to the sales tax question, and we know what happened to Jim Lucas. That was the end of his.
Yeah.
Think of the lieutenant governor from down in Dillon that we had.
George Gosman.
An outstanding man, a type of personality, longtime Republican, but a fine legislator in the sense that he, like Dave Manning and others, knew they were there to see that the state of Montana operated properly in those days.
Do you remember a fellow who was Speaker of the House in the late 50s by the name of McDonald? Was it John McDonald?
I think his name is John. I can see his face. Yes. John McDonald. I'm trying to think. He's not the McDonald. No. Is he the McDonald that came from Geyser?
Could be. I don't know. There was a hot issue during the 1959 legislative session involving what they called public utility districts.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, yes. That the Montana Power and the co-ops were fighting as to who was going to be serving certain areas. And it was. It was a very hot issue. And thank goodness I'm not involved in anything like that. It was finally settled somewhat amicably and did work out, and is working today. Where in the urban areas, it'll be the Montana Power was to serve, and then the agricultural areas, why it was to be the co-ops, as it has. The big argument came over the fact that the cooperatives were not paying a full tax that the Montana Power had to pay because of the taxation situation, one being a for-profit and the other being, in effect, not a non-profit exactly, but something like that, and they were borrowing money from the federal government at 1-2% interest, unheard of for other the private utilities, I'm sure.
Let's see, Clyde Hawks.
Clyde Hawks from down in
Hardin, I think.
Hardin
is where.
Yes, Hardin. Mm-hmm. He was a legislator that he carried lots of bills. He carried too many bills, as I recall. We used to try and tell him, you can't do that. But I think he was trying to carry them for many people, and he was on an Indian reservation. And it was the first effort, I think, that anybody had made to bring Indian legislation up. And he was more—he was not a real leader in the sense. He was just carrying it. But Clyde, a very likable fellow, very good legislator, very attentive, and I don't think he'd miss any sessions. He'd be there.
Frank Hazelbaker.
Frank Hazelbaker from the great Hazelbaker family of Dillon. Good Republican politician, happy-go-lucky, knew where the bodies were buried. And I think in those days you'd have to say the people that I've mentioned along with, he was a, well, Gosman was his mentor. And Frank, yes, Frank wanted to be governor. But
Frank's father was lieutenant governor and ran for governor and lost a close race.
He did that. And then following that, he became, governor of Hawaii. When we appointed people out there, he was in charge in Hawaii after that. Before that became a state, remember?
That doesn't sound like too bad of a deal.
Frank ended up living here in Missoula, you know. Yes, Frank Hazelbaker.
Gene Turnage.
Well, Gene Turnage was an outstanding legislator. Came to the House. As a lawyer, he too was in law school the same time I was, so we were good friends. And this was all to my benefit. And the only reason I say it, if you're going to lobby over there, you have to have friends, and they have to be your friends, but they have to trust you, and you have to be trustworthy. Well, knowing people like Lucas and Gene was he's a very intelligent man, no question about it. A good lawyer. We used to call him a country lawyer, but he did very well, first as county attorney in Lake County and then on to the legislature. And Gene was an awfully good friend of mine, but he could never help me because his father was a railroad, trying to think exactly what he was. I think he was a signal repairman for the Northern Pacific Railroad from Polson down to Thompson Falls. So when railroad bills came up that were contrary to what the railroad management thought, I would be on one side and Gene would be on the other.
Gene generally voted with the railroad employees because
because
his father-in-law was a...
His father, really. He used to tell me very flatly, Joe McElwain, who was a legislator from Powell County, later to become president of the Montana Power, his father was worked for the Milwaukee Railroad. He was another that used to tell me, don't come and lobby me. Don't talk to me about this.
Those real labor issues. Huh?
Those are labor issues. Issues that labor had not been able to get accomplished through bargaining, they brought to the legislature.
Yeah.
And that was my job to see.
to put the squelch on them if you could.
Well, try to hold your finger in the dike.
I see.
And it became a pretty good hole at times.
And then, of course, Gene Turney went on to become Chief Justice.
Yes, he did. And a very fine Chief Justice, in my opinion.
Jim Hoy.
Jim Hoy represented the oil people in the legislature, so to speak, because the law firm where he came from represented all the oil people of eastern Montana, the big oil people, just as I was there for the railroads representing the Milwaukee Railroad. Jim was an easygoing lobbyist. The rest of us might be working our head off. Jim floated, but he got his job done.
Then he went on to be a legislator.
Yes, he was a legislator.
In the 60s, he was a legislator, I think, from both the Senate and the House and Senate.
Both the House and Senate. He was there with that group of, they were all about the same age. The Nutter group, Clyde Hawks. You can go through all of those fellows about the same age together.
Jim Felt.
Jim Felt was a lawyer from down in Billings. Hardworking, very serious-minded legislator. And if he suffered a defeat, he took it badly. He couldn't quite roll with a punch like many did, and I suppose that was normal for human nature, but he always used to be very upset if something didn't work right. However, he worked hard on some legislative matters, but he was in competition with a fellow by the name of Tommy Tao, another legislator who was the exact opposite of Jim Felt. And they sparred. Both of them were from Billings. Tao was they were both very articulate. That was the thing. And you had Senate arguments, and if you knew that a bill was coming up that they'd be on, the Senate galleries would be packed to listen to both of them. And that often happened with Turnage, too. When Turnage was the floor leader, majority leader in the Senate, we'll say, and he handled things very well, but he was a man that could help compromise. He could mediate. So we didn't have too many of those startling debates. But we had them with Tommy Tallon.
You know, I've heard it said, and I got in enough of this to, I think, probably agree with it too, that even when Turnage was the minority leader in the Senate, he was very influential. I don't know whether it'd be fair to say he was the de facto majority leader, but he could usually, it was almost impossible to beat him if it was important to him.
Yeah, it was. And when he used to have us doing things, this is something that happens to lobbyists that people don't know. You might be called on to get in and help do some things that had no connection to what you were there for. And it's sometimes you felt you were being kind of crossways because... and Turnage was one that would come to you, as Nutter would do once in a while, and say, look, I got to have some help on this, and you're a good friend of so-and-so's over there. Now, you go over and tell him that Senate Bill 34 is just what we've got to have, and he's hung up on a thing, and I want you to, well, take him out to dinner, do whatever you have to, and get him full of wine or something, drink him up, get him.
And you're thinking, what in the heck does this have to do with me?
Well, it had nothing to do, but you know that this is part of your job as a lobbyist.
Sure, yeah.
And you're there to help the legislators legislate. Take the example of a man from here who was a senator, Eddie Dussault. Now, Eddie couldn't possibly get around to read all the bills, so I used to read, and we gave Eddie printouts, one little two-paragraph printouts about a bill every morning to kind of keep him up to date so that he...
Who's we?
My office, the railroad office that I operated, where I had readers, as I told you, John Connor and Arthur Lamy Jr. They would prepare this for me at night. We were working in our office till midnight, usually every night, and it was a tough go. to do those things, and you were up at 6:30 in the morning out to do things. Maybe you had meetings with legislators, maybe other lobbyists. We had a group of lobbyists that met every Monday morning at 7 o'clock, usually in Tim, after Tim built his motel out there. And it was headed up by various people. Jerry Anderson, whom you know, was very active among those. Most all of us were graduates of the university here.
And what did you have in common?
We had in common two or three things. One, if we saw that something was coming down the pike that was going to cause a lot of discussion, maybe it was going to disrupt somebody, like Leonard Eccles say, we got two trucking bills in there that are going to put us out of business. Oh. Well, it was none of our business, but was all of a sudden that became a concern to us. And if we had a chance to tell somebody that we could sit down and visit with about those bills, we did it. Didn't matter who you were. So we kind of tried to help each other. The other thing that we met for was the whole university system. We had people there that had gone to school in Billings, and we had lots of Bobcats among us lobbying, and they were all there together. And we wanted to be sure that we got the money for the university system.
It wasn't just Grizzlies. You had Bobcats and Grizzlies and everybody. And
yeah.
And these were association lobbyists, pretty much. You talked about Leonard Eccles was a trucker, and Jerry Anderson represented what, I guess?
He was representing green stamps.
At that time, but he also was represented oil that I can remember.
I think he was involved with the oil people. Some oil.
And you represented the railroads. Was the Anaconda Company or the Montana Power Company involved in that group?
No, not particularly. No, we didn't have anybody in that group. Bob Corrette wasn't there, and no, George O'Connor wasn't there. No, that was just a group of fellas on the university mainly. We were concerned to see if we could get things. And I remember I dealt with a man by the name of, I wish I could recall his name, a senator from over in eastern Montana who was second on finance and claims, and he was handling the university appropriations. He called me in, and it had been just after we allowed the dormitories to be both men and women in the same dorm, co-ed dorms, and he was Corny Thiessen, very much a religious man. I think he actually was kind of a preacher, was he not?
Yes. Yeah.
Called me in and sat down in the office and said, I want you to get the word back to the president over at the university that if he will cut out those co-ed dorms, there'll be an additional $800,000 going to the university. Woo! So, of course, I'm right on the phone to President Bowers telling him right now, that's terrible. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, how do we handle things like that? Makes it a little difficult because Corny had been good to me, and he was. We got along fine, but on that point, he was quite upset. I have nothing to do with. It's nothing to do with railroads, but it's the university now.
And he knew you had that connection.
Oh yes, he did.
Now, Ty, I'm curious to know. You mentioned that this group of association lobbyists, they were mostly business lobbyists.
Mostly business. Oh, business.
Was it by invitation, or did you just happen to? Did you meet? I think on a regular basis?
Yeah, we tried to meet every Monday morning if we could. We wouldn't always have the same number of people there because they'd have other commitments.
And you just kind of talk over generally what was going on in the legislature
that's
during
right.
the week.
And
you'd, if you possibly could, you'd try to help each other.
That's what we tried to do.
Yeah. Do you know if that's still going on?
No. John Delano tells me it doesn't have it anymore. You know, I usually had John there with me in the morning. Or maybe John Willard, one or the other of us. But yes, we enjoyed that. Let's go one step further, if I may, just to talk about the fact that talk about Gene Turnage. Gene was in the Senate, and somehow I'm not sure, but what he may have been, well, he was apparently the majority leader. And the question arose about a matter of a $10 million bonding bill to build a new building out here, which later was to become the TV building, Arts and TV, and President Bowers was the president. And President Bowers, bless his soul, fine man, had a tough time out here as president. He couldn't make up his mind on anything, and the situation came down to this. Yes, the legislature, you fellas in the Senate, said, we'll do this. We'll give you $8 million, but it's up to you to get the other $2 million. The other presidents of the university group were very much opposed to this. They said, this is setting a precedent, and it means that any time we come in here to get money to build buildings, we're going to have to go out and get some private money to finish the job. And that isn't the way the state's supposed to be doing it. They're supposed to be allowing us to bond, so forth and so on. Al Turnage and I were working on this, and I'm the in-between liaison between Dr. Bowers. And he had a vice president by the name of Patty Douglas, a very bright girl, but she was completely impatient to everything in the world, a good friend of mine. And they were staying together. They were Jorgensen's, had rooms right adjoining each other, and they were working on their budget all the time, a matter with the legislator. So I would go over there in the evenings and sit down with him and tell him what Turnage had told me we were going to have to do. And he gave us a deadline. He said, you go tell Dr. Bowers that by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning we have to have a decision on this, one way or the other, or the bill's dead. We got other stuff, fish to fry. Okay. So I went over it that night, and we had a terrible time trying to come to a conclusion. And finally, Mrs. Douglas said, now look, either we do it or we don't right now, and the question, Ty has to have this to go back in the morning. Well, he said, I'd like to think about it tonight. I'd like to think about it. Can you be here at 8 o'clock in the morning? I said, sure, I'll be right here. We had another meeting at 8. Same, he had indecision. He said, the pressure on me is terrific from the other presidents and the other staffs, and particularly over at Bozeman. I forget who was president at that time in Bozeman. But I'm dealing with the vice presidents I know who from Bozeman who really wanted to get this thing moving because they had some fish to fry too. Finally, he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, is it yes or no? And she looked him right in the eye, and he said, well, and he shook his head like that. And she said, Ty, it's yes. Get out of here. So I ran to, and I went up to see our friend Gene, and I told him, and the bill went through. And in the meantime, I didn't know where we were going to quite get that money, but I was visiting.